If you have a Bible, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Luke, chapter 18. We'll get to that in a second. I mentioned a few weeks ago that we are, instead of doing like a normal series, which is what we've pretty much only done at this church, like a sermon series, I thought it might be interesting, just an interesting sort of change of pace this fall, instead of doing a series, to use the lectionary to sort of guide what we do. And if you don't know what the lectionary is, it's this document that lots of different churches and denominations all over the world use as sort of a guide for, here are some passages that lots of other churches and groups are going to be talking about on this particular day. And they usually give you four passages to choose from. And so I just thought, like, where... I became kind of curious, just like, where would the conversation lead us if I stopped just trying to plan out series, and instead I surrender control of the Sunday topics and begin asking, like, okay, well, if we just sort of followed the same path that lots of other churches all over the world are doing, where will that lead us? And it's interesting because today we're going to be looking at a parable. And the reason that's kind of interesting, if you were here over the summer, we spent all summer looking at the parables of Jesus. And we spent like 13 weeks, I think, just going through the different parables. And it turns out there are over 40 parables in the different stories of Jesus. So as many as we did, we barely got through a quarter of them. And it's so funny, like, the minute I say, like, okay, I'm just going to not choose what we do, and we're going to let the lectionary sort of guide us, it got us right back to the parables. And it turns out this is one of the parables that we didn't talk about over the summer. It's sort of like, oh, somehow we continue to end up at the same destination no matter how we get there. It's like, it's maybe a flawed metaphor, but when I first moved to the Metroplex when I was 19 and I came here to go to college, I kept getting lost everywhere I would go, and I kept accidentally ending up at the airport. And I don't know how every road in all of DFW always ends up at the airport, but they do. And so I just sort of felt like, unless I'm actually needing to go to the airport, I always end up at the airport. So this is, again, flawed metaphor, but that's sort of what it felt like as I was preparing for this. Like, oh, we're back at the parables. How do we end up all the way back here at the parables? But this is one we haven't talked about, so we'll maybe be able to explore some interesting new territory. So all that to say, we're starting in the book of Luke, chapter 18, and... this is, Jesus is about to teach a parable. So in Luke 18, beginning in verse 9, this is on the back of your bulletin, by the way, if you don't have a Bible with you. In Luke 18, beginning in verse 9, it says, to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else. So Luke is, by the way, right out of the gate giving you everything he thinks about this group. Because there are things that Jesus says, and then there are things that the narrator says, and Luke is the person writing this. And so this is not Jesus talking. And Luke is sort of editorializing and letting you know, like, what he thinks about the people who are about to listen to this parable. And his opinion of this group of people is not super high. So he starts out by describing this group of people as some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else. So Luke has some feelings about whoever's going to be listening to this parable. And then it says, so Jesus told them this parable. And then in verse 10 it says, and this is the beginning of the parable. It says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, which is a great way to pray. I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even, and I love you, like, just gesture, even like this guy, even like this tax collector. And then in verse 12, it says, I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance, and he would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you, this is Jesus talking, he says, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So this feels like a really straightforward parable. This feels like one guy is arrogant, one guy is humble. Jesus says the guy who was humble was like justified or was honored in some sort of way, while the guy who was arrogant wasn't. So again, it feels like, what else is there to say? This is very straightforward. But here's the thing. There's a lot going on beneath the surface that we don't see, which has been sort of a consistent theme every time we've looked at any of these parables. And one of the things that we don't see, because most of us grew up in like a westernized American context, and we probably, if you grew up going to church in America specifically, but if you grew up going to church and reading stories about Jesus, you probably grew up with a pretty much locked in preconceived notion that the Pharisees in the New Testament are the bad guys, right? And so that tends to be sort of how it's framed. And so when you and I generally, again, if you grew up in this sort of context, when you hear the word Pharisee, we go to like, oh, these are the guys who are against whatever it is that Jesus is doing. And so we have these preconceived notions that the Pharisees are the bad guys. And we also probably, again, if you grew up in this sort of context, grew up with the notion that the tax collectors are this group of people who are like marginalized and put upon and not that well regarded in society. And so we have sort of this way of looking at these two groups of people, Pharisees and tax collectors, as if the Pharisees are the bad guys and the tax collectors are like the victims and like the potential good guys in the story. Here's the thing though, in the world that Jesus is telling the story to, those expectations are totally inverted. So if you are a person in the first century listening to this, you don't see the Pharisee as the bad guy and the tax collector as the good guy. You see the whole world in exactly the opposite terms. In the first century, so in order to understand this parable, first of all, we have to understand how the people that are listening to this would have thought about Pharisees and tax collectors. So a thing that I have said probably more than any other thing in the history of the church is the following sentence. In the first century, the Roman Empire occupied the territory of Judea. That's a thing you can almost never talk about the stories in the New Testament without at least getting into that one bit of information. The Roman Empire has full control over the region of Judea at this time. And so lots of different people, which by the way, is not great. There's lots and lots of people who are not super thrilled about Rome being in charge. And so part of that meant like there's Roman soldiers all over the place. There's a violent occupation going on. But part of it is people are being overtaxed, like up to 90% of their income in some situations. There is sort of like this very kind of tense, like violence could happen at any time. We don't have control over ourselves. The Roman Empire is taking control over our religious centers. There is a lot of powerlessness and fear and anger that is being felt beneath the surface, or not even beneath the surface, just all over the place, just in the atmosphere. There's like this hum of anxiety and anger that just is ever present at the time. So the Pharisees are a group of people who believed that the reason the occupation of Rome had happened was because the people had lost their way. And so the belief was, if we can reclaim our own religious identity, even in the midst of Roman occupation, then God will reward us. And so the notion was, we have been given this ancient sacred identity. And the Pharisees believed that even though Rome is here, we can still reclaim that identity. We can still have a connection to our stories and our scriptures and our place in the world. And so the people at this time would look at the Pharisees as, oh, these are like the last holdouts. These are like the guardians of our sacred core identity. The Pharisees aren't the villains to the people who lived in the first century. The Pharisees are like the thing standing between the people and a total loss of cultural identity. So the Pharisees are highly respected in the community. They're generally regarded to be people most associated with helping the community maintain its moral and spiritual integrity in the midst of, again, Roman occupation. And so in sermons and Bible studies, we often see the Pharisees at their worst, but that's not how people in the first century would have seen them. And I realize like they probably don't get a really great telling. Just if I was a Pharisee, I would be like, I don't really love the New Testament. The New Testament does not paint me in a great way. But the Pharisees are like they're sort of the early generations of what would become known as the rabbis. So the Pharisees, for as much as pastors like to sort of like drag the Pharisees, like there was a lot of love and regard for them at this time. Tax collectors, on the other hand, totally the opposite. If you are a tax collector, that's not a thing you were born into. You chose that line of work. And here's how tax collectors worked. Tax collectors were not like poor, marginalized people. Tax collectors were the people who were getting rich while everybody else was getting poor. Because when Rome took over, when Caesar moved into town or set up his troops in town, one of the ways that Caesar continues to fund his ever-growing empire and army is to collect taxes from the people in the territories he's already occupied. So then they would go into these territories and they would appoint people to be, or they would basically just hire anybody who was willing to do it, to be tax collectors. And so what they would tell the tax collectors basically was, look, it's going to be your job to go door to door once a week to all of your friends and neighbors and collect taxes for Caesar. But also, because you're doing all this work, you get to keep some of the money yourself. So here's how it works. A portion of what you collect will go to Caesar. A portion of what you collect will go to your local like ruling entity. But also, whatever you collect on top of that, that's yours. And so tax collectors are people who are using the power of the Roman Empire to get rich for themselves while their neighbors and friends are being exploited and going deeper and deeper into poverty. So if you are at this time, if you're sitting here listening to Jesus tell this parable, and you hear a story where one of the characters is a Pharisee and the other one's a tax collector, your first thought isn't, oh, this poor tax collector. Your first thought is, I'm glad I'm not like the tax collector too, because everybody hates the tax collector. The tax collectors are the worst. They're rich, they're powerful, they're exploiting their neighbors. If you were in the first century and you were trying to tell a story and you needed your story to have like a really understandable villain, tax collector would be a good like stand-in if you just needed like a shorthand for what the bad guy, like if today you're telling stories and you need just like, okay, what's a really quick way to explain that somebody's like not a great person in the story? You would say like, well, this person's like a Nazi or like a Klan member or like a frat guy. You know what I mean? Like some, like I brought a little bit of my own baggage into that. I'm sorry. But you know what I mean? popped collars and flip-flops in the middle of winter. I don't trust that guy. So anyway, so that is a way that you would sort of like really quickly explain, like, this guy is no good. And so Jesus starts a story by saying one guy here is a Pharisee, another guy is a tax collector. Everybody in the room is like, okay, the Pharisee is the good guy and the tax collector is the bad guy. That's what you expect. So what Jesus here is doing is he's flipping everybody's expectations. He's subverting something just by telling this story in this way. So one of the things he's doing here is he's breaking down binaries. There's an expectation that this group of people is good and this group of people is bad. And Jesus is saying that's not how the world works. You can't naturally assume that just because this person is associated with this thing and this other person is associated with this thing, that they're either all good or all bad. That's not how the world works. The world is not black and white. There is no like binary system where everybody fits into one of two categories. So over and over and over again, Jesus continues to break down these structures and these understandings of black and white, good and bad. So he's doing that already. So if you're in the room listening to Jesus, there is a part of you that's like, okay, I don't even understand this story now. If the Pharisee is in the wrong and the tax collector is in the right, like, what are you even supposed to do with a story like this? So another thing that's interesting, by the way, because again, we tend to look at this as though every single thing that comes out of the Pharisee's mouth is bad and everything that comes out of the tax collector's mouth is good. There's other stuff going on also that says like maybe it's a little bit more complicated than that. Because another thing that's interesting here is that both of these guys are praying a version of something that occurs in the Psalms. So if you would jump back over to Psalm chapter 17. And the Psalms, by the way, are this, it's this ancient document of, it's just this collection of ancient Hebrew poems. And what you have throughout the Psalms is you have this sort of expression and reflection of like kind of the emotional and spiritual journey of humanity. What the Psalms are supposed to do, the Psalms aren't supposed to be like all good or all bad. What the Psalms are supposed to do is they're supposed to show you like, this is the full range of human experience in the world. So, and a lot of the Psalms are just meant to be prayers set in like poetic form. So you have the Psalm in Psalm 17, it's written by a guy named David. And in verse 3, it says, though you probe my, it's a prayer. Though you probe my heart, though you examine me at night and test me, you will find that I have planned no evil. My mouth has not transgressed. Though people tried to bribe me, I have kept myself from the ways of the violent through what your lips have commanded. My steps have held to your path. My feet have not stumbled. So basically the message of this, or the general understanding of this prayer is, I've been faithful and I've been doing all I can, or I'm doing my best. And I have a certain level of confidence that I am currently, at least today, I'm on the right path. And so there's a certain amount of, there's a certain amount of self-confidence, there's a certain amount of I'm doing okay-ness to it. And so when we read the Pharisee's prayer, the part where he says, like, I fast twice a week and I do these things, that in and of itself is not wrong. You know what I'm saying? Like he's basically saying, like, I'm making choices in my life and I feel good about the choices. I feel like, at least for today, I'm on the right path. Like, so that's not the problem. The problem is not that the Pharisee isn't also like beating his breast and like feeling terrible about himself. Although, that is also reflective in the Psalm. So if you go to Psalm 51, in Psalm 51, just again, same writer, by the way, same exact writer, David. So in Psalm 51, beginning in verse 1, it says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you are right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth. Sinful from the time my mother conceived me, which is kind of like a poetic way of saying, I cannot remember a time before I wasn't ashamed of who I've become. Like I basically saying like, I hate what I have become. So this one poet in one place says, I'm doing okay. Things are going well. I feel like I'm making good choices. I feel like I'm becoming who I was created to be. And then in another poem, same poet says, I can't remember a time when I didn't hate who I was becoming. So both are there. So when you look at this parable that Jesus tells, the Pharisee prays one, the tax collector prays the other, and at face value, it's like, okay, so both of these ideas are present in the Psalms. What's different, though? What do you not see in the Psalm? The problem isn't the prayer of, I feel like I'm doing okay, or, and the other side of the prayer of, like, I can't, like, I hate who I'm becoming. Like, both of those are part of the journey. So the problem isn't either of those things, but the thing that sort of differentiates it is how the Pharisee begins. So if you go back to Luke 18, in verse 11, it says, the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. So the problem isn't, I feel like I'm doing okay today. The problem is, at least I'm not that guy, right? The thing that separates one guy from the other isn't how he prays. The problem is when he begins to look around and begin to find other people who can make him feel better about himself. So if we're to take both the Psalms seriously, again, both perspectives are part of the human experience. But the problem arises when one of them looks at the other and begins to feel better about himself because he's not as, at least I'm not as bad as that guy. The Pharisee is using judgment against another person in order to inflate his own sense of worth. This is where it begins to sort of break down. This is where you find the difference between what the Pharisee says and what we find in the Psalms. So what is interesting about this, and this is gonna make everybody wanna just lay your head down for a minute, but this parable is a mind trap, and here's why. Because the minute we read this and we immediately identify who the bad guy in the parable is because he prays, at least I'm not like this guy. And so we identify who the bad guy is and we say, I'm really glad I'm not like this guy when we read the parable. So the minute I start to feel contempt for the Pharisee, I become the Pharisee. So the minute I read this and think, yeah, come to think of it, I'm really glad I'm not like people who are super self-righteous and judgmental, you know, just like that guy. Oh, okay, then you just became the thing that you said you're glad you're not. And so, like, again, it's like Jesus is like setting a mind trap just by listening to the story, you are trapping yourself into becoming one of the characters in the story. Are you with me? So, like, it's like if I stood up here and said, like, everybody stop thinking about zebras right now, everybody would think about zebras. You just did. And so what Jesus does is, like, he tells you a story where you feel contempt for one of the characters because that character feels contempt for one of the other characters. So again, just by listening to the story, it's like, this is sort of like what the practice of meditation is for. It's to stop and notice like what thoughts you're having, like to just sort of observe what you're thinking when you're thinking it. It's this odd sort of like stepping away from yourself for a second. And so if you read this parable and you notice the things that you think when you're reading the parable, you realize like, oh my goodness, like this is a total mind trap because Jesus just got me to become the thing that I say I'm glad I'm not that. Are you with me? It's very, again, if you're ready to just like lay your head down for a minute, I totally get it. But this is sort of, and by the way, this is the insidious thing about hating people because they hate people. Like I remember several years ago, there was a guy named Fred Phelps who had created an organization that we could loosely describe as a church. And he sort of became, his church sort of became known as this organization that was kind of fueled by just hatred. I mean, it was mostly homophobia and transphobia, but they branched out. That was just sort of like where they got their start. That was the thing that they were most known for. And so they would travel the country and they would protest like school openings and funerals and just pretty much any Comic-Con, like anything that they could get near, they would always protest it. And just bring a lot of like anxiety and hate into the space. And the guy who created this thing was this guy, Fred Phelps. And I remember like the news had started to report that Fred Phelps was about to die, that he was on his deathbed. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure I'm sad to hear that. Like, that's not news that I'm terribly sad to hear about. And so I began to sort of feel this wave of like, am I happy that this guy is gonna die? Like, cause that's problematic, is it not? And so then I began to sort of like think, just sort of notice the thoughts you're having and this realization of like, why do I hate this guy so much? Well, I hate this guy so much because he's out there hating everybody and he's out there like teaching other people to hate. But by hating this guy, don't I become this guy? You know what I mean? Like, do I not, like, if the biggest grudge I have against this guy is that he's so capable of hating and teaching other people to hate, and then I then internalize my own hate and begin to hate him, then I become the thing that I hate by hating it. Are you with me? So again, I realize like this is, maybe another cup of coffee would have been really useful before we started, but this is the whole idea, is that a lot of times in trying so hard to not become a thing, we become the thing that we hate. And so the insidious thing about what Jesus is showing us about ourselves is it's deeply possible to, on our journey to become who we're trying to become or to who God has created us to be, it is possible that we go looking for other people to set ourselves against and to hate and to say, well, at least I'm not that. And what Jesus is saying is maybe that's not the point. Maybe the point here is not to identify and celebrate our, like, just be so glad for myself for not being the thing that I'm not, because maybe that doesn't actually get us anywhere. And the thing about it is, if you back up again and kind of look at it, the Pharisee doesn't need to compare himself to the tax collector. If you go back to the Psalm 17, the guy does not waste any time saying, well, at least I'm not like these other guys. You know what I mean? His thing is like, today on my journey, I'm feeling okay. I'm feeling like things are working out. I feel like I'm making some choices that I should be making. Like, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. The guy doesn't need to then go and compare himself to somebody else. He's already loved. He's already on a journey that has led him to a place of being loved and forgiven and seen. And so to compare himself to anybody else is not necessary. So a couple of observations about this parable. The first observation I would say is your value has nothing to do with anybody else. Like, we spend lots and lots of time comparing ourselves to other people. And this is, and we've talked about this before, but this is sort of the insidious nature of any app that you have on your phone that allows you to scroll and look at other people's lives, because everybody's posting the best parts of their lives. And so it becomes sort of this notion of, I feel really, really bad about myself because my kids aren't wearing matching outfits today, or because this thing isn't happening the way it's happening for somebody else. And so there's this sort of like comparison trap that we get into. But then there's also sort of the negative comparison trap, which is like, oh wow, they seem to be having a rough time. I'm really glad that's not, you know, at least I'm not like blowing up my own life like that guy. You know what I mean? And so it becomes sort of this weird, like, comparison on either side of it is really kind of lethal, because it can either allow us to feel really terrible about who we are, or it can allow us to feel superior, and neither is particularly helpful, you know? And so what Jesus, I think, is saying with this is like, maybe your worth and your value has nothing to do with somebody else's struggles and somebody else's journey. You don't have to be glad that somebody else is having a bad time in order to acknowledge that your life is going okay right now. You know what I mean? And so Jesus is saying, like, your value, this guy's value, has nothing to do with anybody else. And again, like, he's already messing with everybody's points of view, because he's allowed the Pharisee to be the bad guy and the tax collector to be the good guy in the story. And so he's sort of like kind of shaking up the whole thing and saying, like, maybe all those ways that we look around and we try and offer ourselves some sort of condolence or some sort of like self-satisfaction, because at least I'm not that guy. Maybe Jesus is saying that's really not helpful, and that is not helping us at all become who we were created to be. So the first observation is your value has nothing to do with anybody else. So how you compare yourself to other people, the worst things that people say about you, those are not the things that determine who you are and the value that you have in this world. So that's the first observation. The second observation is who you are not is not nearly as interesting as who you are. The guy's whole perspective is, at least I'm not this guy. I was at Kroger a few weeks ago. I was looking for a parking spot, and I was driving, and I noticed there was a car parked, and it was like this little Toyota sedan, and it had one bumper sticker on the back of it, and the bumper sticker said, not a liberal. And I saw that, and I was like, great. So glad we cleared that up. I was curious, and now I'm not anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I know three things about this person. One, they shop at Kroger. Two, they drive a Toyota. And three, not a liberal. That's all I know about this person. It's the only bumper sticker. No other bumper stickers. Like it's like this guy got the bumper sticker. I'm assuming it was a guy. Got the bumper sticker, put it on the back of his car. I was like, that'll show him. You know what I mean? Like, but okay. Like, now I know this thing about you. So is that interesting? Like, does that help you to like? Is that the one thing that defines who you are? Like, to be able to identify a thing that you're not? Like, is that the most interesting thing about you? And I think what Jesus here is trying to say in a certain way is like, no. Who you're not is not that interesting. Who you are might be infinitely interesting. I do this too. I mean, it's easy for me to pick on a guy I've never met before who drives a car, but it's a whole lot, it's one guy who drives a car. But it's another thing to just like look inside and to ask like, okay, is there any bit of that in me? And yeah, there totally is. Like, it's really easy for me to look at what like larger churches or more traditional churches do, and for me to sort of feel better about what we're doing here in comparison, because at least we're not doing those things. You know what I mean? Because I grew up in a system that tells you that bigger is better, and I've been trying to sort of unlearn that habit. And as part of kind of that mental exercise, sometimes I go to this place where I'm like, well, the bigger places have all these problems, and I'm really glad we don't have those problems. And so I begin to sort of define what we do here based on the thing that we're not, which is a megachurch. And so that's not absolutely helpful. Like, what if that was just like the homepage on our website, Collective Church, not a megachurch? Like, what good would that do? Would anybody be like, oh, I'm definitely going to check that out? You know what I mean? Like, who's doing that? So it's totally possible for us to do this, for us to directly identify not with the things that we are, but with the things that we're not. And so I cannot be who I was created to be if all I know about myself is what I'm not. So like this guy, his prayer is not a tax collector. But what if instead of not a tax collector, this guy had said, thank you, God, that I am loved. And thank you that I am worthy of love. I'm a human being. I am a father. I'm a friend. I'm a member of a community. I'm someone who tries his best to be generous and kind whenever I can. And sometimes I feel like I'm doing it okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's way more interesting than not a tax collector. And so, or I mean, like, for myself. Like, what if instead of like not a mega church pastor, what if instead it was, I'm a person, I'm trying my best, I'm trying to be generous, I'm trying to be loving, I'm trying to create a space for people who feel like there's no space for them in the world. And like, to me, that's way, way more interesting than not a fill in the blank. And so maybe in our quest to become who we're trying to be, maybe one of the things we need to let go of is the impulse to identify ourselves by all the things that we're not. And I think that's sort of, again, sort of the mind trap of this parable, is that the minute I begin to say, well, I'm glad I'm not the Pharisee, then I become the Pharisee. And I become sort of like aware of like how easy it is for me to like trip and just like almost effortlessly just sort of stumble into sort of this way of seeing the world. Well, at least I'm not this thing. And so, just sort of as an aside, I feel like I should just say this, but this doesn't mean that we shouldn't call out like destructive or abusive behavior. So it's one thing to say like, I'm glad I'm not a whatever. It's a whole other thing to say like, over here in this system, there are some problems and people are being harmed. Like it's one thing to compare ourselves and try to find value in the thing that we're not. It's a whole other thing to say like, there's some abusive behavior going on. And it needs to be called out so that it will be stopped. Like that's like, we definitely need to do that. Like if, we need to call out things like abuse or racism or sexism or any other things that we see going on in our midst that we might be able to speak about. So that's a different thing than being able to differentiate ourselves and find value in like all the things that we're not. It's one thing to try and change something so that people can stop being harmed. It's another thing to say like, I'll feel better about myself when I realize how better I am than somebody else. So that's a different sermon for a different day. But for now, you are loved. And you are worthy of love, and that has nothing to do with who you're not. Like, the person that frustrates you the most has nothing to do with your value. You are exactly who you were created to be. You are loved exactly as you are. And you don't need to go looking around and finding other people to sort of like downgrade so that you can feel better about that. It's not helpful. Who you're not is not nearly as interesting as who you are. So may we define ourselves by who we are. May you remember that you are loved and it has nothing to do with anybody else. May you see the humanity in those that we are so easily, that we can so easily dehumanize. And instead of identifying ourselves and separating ourselves, quite frankly, by pushing that group of people aside and saying, well, at least I'm not that, may we instead acknowledge the humanity in that group of people, whoever they may be. And instead of saying, well, at least I'm not that, and be able to say, I wonder if all the worst things that I see over there are actually somewhere in me. And so perhaps the invitation here is to stop comparing ourselves and to say, I'm loved. And instead of standing in judgment against other people, being able to look inward and say, what are the things inside me that I need to pay attention to so that I can become who I was created to be? So may you know that you're loved. May you stop comparing yourself to other people. And may you find that you are worthy of love and that you don't need to look around to find your own value. Let me pray for us. God, we thank you for this story, this parable. We thank you for this this message embedded in the story of we don't need to go looking around at other people's lives to find our own value. May we remember that who we're not is not nearly as interesting as who we are. And for those of us who struggle with that, for those of us who struggle to find that we are loved and worthy of love, may we internalize that, may we believe it down to our bones. May we carry that with us throughout the world. And when we leave this place later, may we leave with more grace and peace than we had when we first arrived. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.